Now, we said before, we said there's a possibility that Prufrock let us go then, you and I, and so forth. And he goes out through the slum to the drawing room. Now, is there a chance that he doesn't go anywhere?
Yeah.
Why?
I originally thought he was all in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you mean?
And what evidence you have to support that interpretation?
Well, the way he jumps around from place to place.
What evidence? The first 35 lines.
That he does not go anywhere?
Yeah, that he doesn't.
Does.
That he doesn't go anywhere.
That he speaks in future tense the whole time. Mm-hmm. Says, let us go, and says, there will be time, there will be this will happen.
No, there's like the yellow fog that runs.
Yeah, but that's not concerning him. I mean, it's concerning him, but it's not speaking to his presence.
In your quote on Orwell, in the first one, it talks about the pure ether of the middle classes.
Okay.
In the pure ether of the middle classes. And
do you read what goes ahead of that? Because that's
important. Well, let's see. It was interesting to see how subtly he disassociated himself from his fellow tramps. He had been on the road 6 months, but in the sight of God, he seemed to imply he was not a tramp. His body might be in the spike, but his spirit soared far away in the pure ether of the middle classes.
Mm-hmm. Now, say if Prufrock is soaring away from something, what is he soaring away from?
Reality. His own dream.
Yeah.
Into his own.
From?
His personages.
Huh?
No.
Let's talk of it in the terms of in these terms first.
It's away from the middle classes.
So it'd be away from the middle classes.
Because the way he's got the women come and go, I'm talking Michelangelo up there, they come as an interruption in the narrative. Mm-hmm.
And right there at the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's one thing.
All right, go ahead.
You kept saying to go to the drawing room where the women are, but in that room, is that the same room?
Okay, now is he standing out in front of the door wanting to go in?
You mean
not if he's going away from middle class.
Okay. Is he going in? If he's going out of a room, what's he going out of? What's he going into? Come and go talking to Michelangelo during the whole poem.
I don't think so.
Okay, what, why, well?
I think it could be, it's not in a room in a conventional sense that we think so.
Or it could be in the room where they are, and he's, those people that are glittering about talking about Michelangelo may be the same people that are going to say that he's got a bald head and he's on the stairs that may be leaving the room.
But it could be his image of the people of what they are. Because like that footnote says that it's going, about what the women are like, and then then he'll have his own thoughts about what they say about his bald head and about, his legs and arms and stuff.
But does he dare leave the room? Because if he leaves the room, he's going to have to go down the stairs. If the women who come and go talk to Michelangelo treat Michelangelo the way they do, they're going to treat him in a certain way too.
Yeah, but in the same
bad about him.
In that room, he's got time. He's got time for everything.
He's got time to come back before the taking of toast and tea.
Well, in that room, it seems those women are
not
realizing that the way they're talking and everything, the way they flit about, they are making visions. They're having visions and revisions and talking about things. And a minute makes these things, and another minute I'm talking about something else, some other aspect of Michelangelo that they know nothing about, but pitch them as, think of pseudo-visions or something.
Yeah. Okay, about using the Orwell thing about the ether in the middle class. and you get the set of the air, so forth, and I get a sense of somehow that dream sustains him more than the so-called reality of the drawing room. We have a question. Down here, let us go and make our visit. I got a little note on the side. Let's get out of here. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Let us go then, you and I, while the evening spread out against the sky. Let's go through these streets. Let's go through these streets. Let's go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go talking to Michelangelo. Right there, at that time. Then you get the yellow fog statement. There will be time to do all these things. There'll be time and time, and we've talked about that. Time for this before the taking of toast and tea. Is there a sense in it that we're not going to miss anything? Does he ever leave that room? I asked before, do we get any movement of Prufrock? From the point of
the fact that they say that in the room the women come and go back to Michelangelo, the fact that they say that twice, and show that he hasn't left between the two times.
Mm-hmm. I think the use of the definite article instead of an indefinite article too makes a difference. In a room the women come and go talking to Michelangelo is different than in the room.
Or is he in the room and they're coming in and going? I wrote on the in the room. I wrote with an exclamation mark, "Oh, get out of here!" Like he's dreaming and they walk in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Let's just talk.
I think he's in the room. I think he's with the women. I think he is with the women as he begins the poem, and he doesn't know how to leave.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, now that the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient euthanized on a table, we can go. Mm-hmm. He says, when it is,
mm-hmm.
let's go, you and I, when the evening is spread. You know,
we'll escape.
I think he's waiting. He's just doing an awful lot of waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be a time when I can get out of this room with these women going back and forth. I got my stick pin on, they think my legs are too thin, mm-hmm. my hair is bald, and they're mocking me out, and I'd really like to get out of here, but I'm not going to leave until the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient.
Okay. In an escape sense, you go through that. You may even talk out loud to yourself. If you're in a tight situation, if somebody's after you or something, then, okay, Kurt, now you're going to get down, Kurt. I've had that experience of talking out loud to myself.
His whole images of himself are images that women coming and going talking with Michelangelo and themselves.
He's a part of that world.
I think he is.
You betcha, Luke. Yes, and we get that coming up.
Yeah.
That's part of how can I presume? I've known all these things. I know it all.
Mm-hmm.
Known them all. I've known it all. I've known, you know, and how can I presume? That's part of his how can I presume?
Yeah.
Because, we'll get to that.
But I don't think he's Bush.
Hmm?
I don't think he's Bush.
And that he is sitting there in his head then thinking, let us go then, you and I. And now we've talked about this as you means the reader, you means the, you know, who does the you mean? The you later means, it seems like some woman, we don't know who. It's a love song. We know that he never sings the love song. But do we know whether he opens his mouth or not? And if he is saying, you know, as you said, Rich, not knowing what to really how to get out of that room, you know, if he says, let's get out of this, this unreal drawing room reality. Let's get out of here. And maybe one, he has to speak because he's a little scared to go himself. Let's go you and I out. Won't go alone. He fears to go alone, perhaps anywhere but in his fantasy. And it's funny that does he dare go out before the universe alone? Well, he says, let us go. And then in this room, he's a very intelligent fellow, and he's listening to this kind of chit-chat. And say he lets go out through those, through that somehow more real world, the slum. Let's get out of here. Here they are talking again. I can't stand it. And is it just, I want to get out of here, or I want to make a statement about this before I go? You know, not only do I want to get out of here, I want to say something very, I want to criticize this reality, shake this universe, what people in the drawing room reality think is real. You know, shall I shake it?
Doesn't he almost seem to try to do that when he talks about Lazarus? That's about himself. He gets, come back, and I can tell you all, I shall tell you all, and if one, but he doesn't.
Yeah, he's questioning whether he should make, whether he can, whether he should, whether it's worthwhile to disturb the universe of the drawing room. Now, does that interpretation start to get some evidence in the poem?
Then the last line seemed to make sense when he talks about the sea girls wreathed in seaweed red and brown, and in the sea chambers, we have lingered in chambers of the sea. Mm-hmm. Seems to relate to the drawing room.
Yeah, like two.
The chambers of the sea might be, the chambers of the drawing room, and the sea girls wreathed in seaweed red and brown, just caught in their own seaweed.
In the last line, then would be, you know, he'd be waking up out of his fantasy, or back into their world, and he drowns.
Oh, he's lost.
Yeah, he can't do it.
He hasn't been able to escape or make a statement. And that's the death.
Can you, again, I want to ask this question, can you come up with different interpretations of the poem, and which are, of this particular poem, which you can, with confidence, I mean, the same person, not just different people disagreeing about the interpretation. I'm not talking about that old thing. But I'm saying, can one person come up with two, say, interpretations of the poem and please Eliot. Does he want to say more than one thing? Does he want to do what most poets dream heaven is like, say 10 things at the same time? It's our problem. We can only say one word at a time here. I want to say a line at a time. Not just a line at a time. I want to say a book at a time. To overcome the time and how I have to spit out things a little bit at a time.
It's kind of like, you know, a piece of art or something, you know, some of the books that you don't have, you know, everyone will have a different interpretation of what that is trying to say. And
that's a question I don't want to talk about though now. See, that's the one about two different people come up with the question, can two people come up with equally impersonally valid interpretations of the poem. I'm not talking about two people. I'm talking about one reader coming up with statements which are different that they think the poem makes, and that pleases Eliot, that the chambers is not only one thing, but maybe two things, maybe even three things. Maybe the you is a girl in the drawing room, the reader, you know, Prufrock asking Eliot, you know, as you know, Virgil's going to lead Dante, the poet, down through hell. I mean, can we come up with three interpretations that run right through this poem? To where the pronoun, where different people are being referred to.
Been careful not to make it specific, and yet, not that you can't read anything into it.
Not that you can read anything into it. Uh-huh. It's ambiguous in very specific ways. Yeah.
I think I could come up with a couple, not too many, different interpretations, any of which. Like maybe two or three, any of which would please Eliot, but I don't think I could come up with more than one at the same time.
Yeah, you go through it. Now what we're doing here is going to be hard, because what we're doing is really, you know, we're taking something that is sort of like, chameleon isn't the right word, but we're saying this you means these different things. And now we're going to try to progress these babies through the poem, or see if they all make it through the poem. And it's hard, boy. It's really hard. Yeah.
I think at this point, anyway, to say that here's a good interpretation and here's a good interpretation, it could mean either this or it could mean that, would put me in the room with the women.
To say either or.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To say
either or.
And not say, this is what it means. But at another time, you know, I think it would specifically mean another thing.
Yeah. That it would come together. Yeah.
In okay. A whole set would wind up.
Important in there, but there's a degree. Mm-hmm. I think in a kind of different intensities that have been coming up in our lives too, that make, you know, like the context of our own lives will make a difference. Like what you said, John, about reading it at 19 or whatever it was. And that it doesn't mean that it's still in your story or whatever at 29.
Mm-hmm.
Like the different.
Mm-hmm. And that there is
different recognition of it.
Yeah.
What we're doing.
Yeah.
Not your story.
Yeah. But it is, many times we ask all the questions that he does. I mean, at different times in our life, it'll seem different at certain times. Like, this do I dare, who am I? You know, who am I? I have just to scribble down something after Vespers, you know, a number of things. But, like, who am I to do life enrichment? You know, who am I to do that? You know, good heavens. I'm trying to create a radical kind of education not based on knowledge or feelings first, but on belief. You know, that's a different thing. Well, who am I? And where are the credentials? And where are the, you know, and so forth. And do you dare? Who am I to presume? And each of us gets this feeling sometimes, you know, so we can relate to it, and certainly, as Elise said before, that Eliot, it isn't what Eliot meant by this poem, but it certainly fed Eliot in being 22 years old, writing a radically new kind of poetry, just totally new kind of poetry. Yeah.
By my calculations, I think he was
29. He was 29 when it was published. Oh. It took him 7 years to get it published. He wrote it in 1910. Mm-hmm. And Ezra Pound was helping him, trying to help him get it published, and even with Ezra Pound's help, it took 7 years to get it published. So he's 22 years old, he's writing a totally new kind of poem, radically new use of language. He's more radical than anyone, and yet he's a classicist. He doesn't fit any camp. And he writes a poem that, in a sense, condemns society. And he's faced with a problem. Do I dare? You know, do let this poem out of my hands and into the walk it down the stairs. After all, I am a member of this civilization, and so forth. Well, so that isn't what he meant by the poem, but that's something that fed him and informed him about the feelings that this. This other fellow would have. Well, let's go on. We've got him, he hasn't gone anywhere. And he's thinking, do I dare disturb the universe? We've talked about that statement. It's a double irony there, that to think that the drawing room is a big enough stage in which to disturb the universe, that's not the expected response. And yet, the double irony is that, yes, one can disturb the universe in a drawing room, if you're in the drawing room. And that's where the only place where the disturbance starts. Thinking about this in terms of saying something, he's gonna do something and he's gonna say something, and then he gets his first, in this stanza he finds his first problem in criticizing. What does he fear? If he criticizes, what happens? If he disturbs this universe, what happens? Why does he feel maybe that he can't criticize at this point? Yeah.
He's not a youthful voice, for one thing. They'll discredit him with his age, and his legs are thin. And because at the end he says, maybe I should roll up my pants, get with the times,
well,
and part my hair in the back and cover the baldness, and maybe this would.
Mm-hmm.
Would help him in that room.
Yeah.
Maybe he feels like he can't criticize something that he's been a part of himself.
That will come, but right in this stanza, if he, you know, right in this stanza, if we say he's saying, I can't criticize, I mean, what is holding him back from criticizing, disturbing the universe in this? Yeah.
Everything's going to change in a minute anyway, and the criticism will be canceled out.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be relevant for the next minute.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the reason why he can't criticize, or is that maybe a rationalization? That's the excuse part. But then what's the reason? You know?
I think he's just chicken. He's afraid of people. They're already he's worried because they're going to say his hair's growing thin and his arms and legs are thin. Mm-hmm. I think he's just scared of what people will say.
Scared to make a decision.
And then he passes it off by saying, well, there's all sorts of time and that's the great equalizer anyway.
He makes a joke out of himself. That's part of the rationalization. He's all tense and then he's kind of
Let's hold on that. Hold on that. Okay. At first he says, okay, if I disturb it and this at first just in walking down the stairs, walking out of this, I'm vulnerable. I'm very vulnerable. I'm mortal. And these people will criticize me, and he can fear that. But there's a kind of he can't criticize in this at this point because of his vulnerability. His weaknesses that people are going to point to, and his fear of getting pointed at like that. And then he'll say, well, again, do I dare disturb the universe? Well, in a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. Decisions and revisions, and then another minute will reverse the revision. You know, oof. He's turning and turning, yeah.
Is the disturbance of the universe possible within the room, or is he saying that it really can't be done until he leaves the room? And that disturbing the universe would actually be to leave the room and stand in that slum with his morning coat and his collar mounting firmly, his necktie rich and modest with his pin, but he'd be out there on the street in the slum, and that would disturb me.
He'd be disturbing that room too, or that reality too.
Yeah.
And he, again, the either or.
Yeah.
You're getting something here where this is something that's hard to believe, but in poetry you can talk with a forked tongue and say, tell the truth out of both forks, you know. I mean, is he trying to go into a room? Is he trying to get out of a room? Is he trying to go from one reality into another? Is he going to, be as odd a duck out there as he is in here? He's an odd duck in this drawing room reality because this poem is going on in his head while people are chatting about Michelangelo. This profound kind of talking and thinking and questioning and not without intelligence. This stuff is going on in his head. He's an odd bird. He's a fish out of water, and we'll mention that later. But then out there, as you say, he's going to look kind of funny too. He's going to look kind of funny too. Yeah.
The idea of being alone, I think, happens whether you're on a slum street or on a in the dark. And that's what he, and that he never, well, at least that was this thing that I felt when I read the poem through this night, was you just simply being, not, you know, but whoever specifically you could put in there, the fact that he is not going to be alone even in this, and have to be surrounded by somebody else. And somebody else is lots of times a protection from taking the question on, whatever your question is, she needs to take on. And so the being alone is really something of an issue in being able to deal with it.
Did say something
to disturb the universe, whether it's in there or on the street, wherever it be. wherever he would be, would disturb the universe in the sense that it would be so radical for him to face it himself and nobody in between.
A person, you know, in any reality is going to disturb, you know, in any room is going to make certain disruptions. And what Lisa's saying is about protection and so forth will come on the next page too. I mean, this kind of, this insulation. But there's a reason for not criticizing, then there's a rationalization here too at the end. Well, it's going to be whatever I decide, I mean, you know, something else is going to happen. And you get the second movement of this part. For I have known them all already, known them all. I have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music of from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase, and when I'm formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I'm pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out the butt ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume to speak? Then what kind of... what gets in the way of the criticizing to make a bold statement, say, an action or a statement? What gets in the way at this in this part?
No, Kathy.
Okay, Kathy, will you say that again? What you said again?
I said I can't criticize because it's part of them.
Criticize
himself. You know, maybe I'm feeling like yelling part of him. You may have a change of heart about something, but you can't enter the group and do anything.
It'd only be met with review because it would say, well, who are you to tell us?
Right, and what they do want is exactly what you've been doing. It's interesting.
I think it's sort of interesting that biblically, you know, when you say somebody knew somebody, it meant sexual relations, which was the act of making them one. And he said he knew them all.
And that's the most intimate thing. I mean, he's inside this. He belongs to this world, as Kathy, I think, is saying. He belongs to this world. He has belonged to it. He is a product of it. Yeah.
It's a strange argument, though. How does one presume unless one actually is a product?
Well, he's going to say that.
Once again, isn't this an excuse rather than a reason?
Well, yeah, you get.
There's no way a stranger to this room could come in and say, this is all foolishness, this is all as nothing. Cut out this little game thing that only someone who has known them all could really, you know, could stand there and do that.
Yeah.
The thing is, how could I presume? What would give him the ability to do that other than to know them all?
Okay.
Anything?
Yeah, well, let me say something here. Look at the kinds of questions too that he's asking when he asks the question later. And we're going to get that odd kind of thing that, well, wait a minute, that's sort of an impossible question. Is it worthwhile after all? But you're not after all. You're talking about, you can't answer that question unless you can see the future. It's an impossible question to it's one we ask a lot. It's one of the nuttiest questions that there is. Is it worthwhile? Will it be worthwhile after all? Well, after all isn't the area. So we can't answer that question. So there's a question that we're asking that we can't answer, but if we keep asking it, it's going to sort of overwhelm us. And here, he's in the position, as Rich says, he knows this reality. I mean, he knows it, and so he's equipped. And yet that very being equipped is, because you can see what's going to happen the minute he opens his mouth. You know? Yet also, the very thing that, the very experience that he has, his knowing it, you know, puts him in a position to see something that's wrong in it, but his having done it puts him in a position to be called a hypocrite, whatever, you know. Because, my gosh, you've been living here, Alfred. You've been doing this. You have... He is... Who are you? You have been measuring out your life, and you're saying we measure out our lives in coffee spoons. What about you? You know, because part of the criticism, I think, is going to hit part of what he's criticizing. It hits him. You know, it's like every time, you know, you talk about every time you make a critical statement, it seems like that criticism applies first to you, too, and then to maybe the person or the people that you're criticizing. It cuts you, there isn't this safe thing, there's always a two-edged thing, you know. I mean, you get cut by the same criticism that you make of another person first. If it's an unjust criticism, then the second guy that gets it maybe is Christ. Yeah.
I was thinking that at the end of this afternoon, talk about this, I said that this big thing of proportion, to get him in proportion, if his life, you know, what is going on with him, and what the question maybe being more helpfully stated for this point, and who is man, and what is man's condition, and what are we, and how can any man say anything about any situation that he's in, because he's already condemned by it, because he does recognize it. You know, that's what you mean by criticism too, where you recognize the fault because you know the fault. You recognize the terrible, the horror of that kind of life because you've been in that life. And you have, it's like, it reminds me a little bit even of the woman of Amos, where you have this idea that there is something else, but you, they haven't got hold of you. There isn't something outside of you to direct you, point you, open your mouth, not even in the sense of a prophet, where the prophet speaks for God. I mean, I'm the voice here, and I presume because I have been commanded to speak. But here it is a thing of, how does anyone presume? You know, you're full of voice. Who are you to point a finger at me? And who, no, you aren't.
It's one of the sort of secrets behind weakness, I mean, that you do, you know, that there is this, you know, confession of those things that people are going to throw at you right off the bat anyway. I mean, if you're just out of a position of strength, you know, and you know, condemning something, I mean, anybody, any eighth grader with a little bit of, you know, logical ability is going to blow you right out of your socks, you know, if you start thinking that you're in a strong position.
We were kind of stuck at that word presume, how should I presume, and, mm-hmm. and in the dictionary definition, one is to venture and to go forth, and another definition of it was how do I take for granted,
The venturing and going forth is neat.
Yeah, going forth, but taking for granted is a whole different slew in disturbing the universe. I mean, how do I take, it can be read in a whole...
Yeah. There's another meaning in presumptuous. I mean, that who am I? I mean, who am I to say this? Mm-hmm. How should I presume to make a criticism? How should I? Who am I to make the criticism? Yeah.
There's also presume upon, and this is how might I go about gaining an advantage over?
Gaining an advantage over.
finding an advantage.
The form always
It's not all those, you know, those, that one and the venturing forth definitions are, look like they're going to shake down, some fruit's going to shake down off of those trees, you know, really do.
If you criticize a venture forth, and you're part of it, well then right there too, he'd be making a step, and he has to accept change in himself, or is just speaking, he just is a total hypocrite if he would say anything, so if he presumes to say something, then he has to take upon himself that he...
He's a part of that. Yeah, I mean, the criticism hits him too.
Yeah, but wouldn't... If he was going to criticize them, wouldn't he be going to do something about... I mean, take the criticism to heart first. I mean, before I even be able to criticize if there's going to be anything, then it would have to be taken to heart in him that the criticism had... was going to bear fruit in him, and he would change or become different.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like that. But
that there would have to be, yeah, there would have to be.
Because he doesn't even know that, yeah, he hasn't made it. It's like deciding to become before you've made the act. But look at what will happen. But he doesn't even know what the question is yet, really. He just has a sense of study. I mean, I don't think.
No, he's still asking. He's still thinking through whether he should do something. To see a situation here as being an intimate member of this particular group, reality, and so forth. He's been doing this for years. He hasn't said anything. He's been going along with it, knowing all the afternoons and so forth. He's a product of it. He's been doing it. And he hasn't said anything yet. And yet inside there's this sort of this idea. Say something. And there's this incredible fear. Just like if I'm sitting here and I'm, you know, if I'm in a group of guys and we fiddle around with drugs, this is, you know, then all of a sudden I say, wait a minute, this is sick, you know. And then I say something. Now I'm going to have some problems to get up enough, screw up enough courage, screw up my courage to the sticking point, to say something, and to say that's wrong. And they will say, well, who are you? Look, you know, you've been doing this, you know. You've been doing this, you sure didn't think it was bad all the time, you know, that you were doing it. Wouldn't believe it.
Sounds like Nixon's abdication speech.
Which?
His abdication.
Yeah. In which you go, make the connection closer.
Like, what would you normally say when you talked about a life which is meaningless? You would cop a plea. I mean, if it's so blatant, if everyone around you is understanding a similar condition, mm-hmm. you would say this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, you say, if I say what we are all doing, you say, I'm wrong. I'm doing a stupid life. I want to walk out, and you can just kiss my bald head goodbye. I'm leaving, you know. But no. He says, if I say they're wrong, mm-hmm. or we are collectively wrong,
mm-hmm.
then I'm going to get pinned on the wall, and mm-hmm. I'm going to go down with the whole schmear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so... You know, I think it still sounds very much to me like a man who is unwilling to admit a condition of his that is deadening.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that the singular law of if you make that statement in this eyes that fix you, you know that
yeah.
And you're in that formulated phrase.
And you've lived in that formulated phrase. I mean, you are in a pigeonhole. And if you say something, huh? That's part of it. What? You?
And they've got another phrase, read it handy.
And then they've got another pigeonhole for you.
Yeah.
You know, the back 40 of your mind where you send idiots, you know? You just kind of exiled them there, you know? But okay. And they, in a sense, okay, let's just go through. For I have known them all, and this huge thing, and then, you know, you get this grand scale. And then two lines later, coffee spoons. You know. It's all been this, you know, I've been measuring out my life with coffee spoons. That's a neat image in that it's been so careful. These coffee spoons are like these little baby spoons, you know, just and you two-finger jobs. You're never giving out more life than you can hold in the two fingers with a pinky out. You know. These tiny little spoons. And I've measured out my life in coffee spoons. He'll talk about this in here. Prudent, right? Prude. Okay.
Is measured out like giving away, like I give you this measure, or is it marking time for the book?
I think both, in the sense that it's like, you know, it's draining away, like through an hourglass business, you know. I mean, it's going, but it's always this little, and very careful, and a little bit at a time. Not this sort of, you know, not a Jacob life that, you know, bam, he grabs the angel and wrestles till morning and limps for the rest of his life, but by God, he got the blessing. He stole the birthright of angels, you know, and he's blessed because he fought God and grabbed it, embraced it, and so forth. And here's this little bit. Now this next one is this next passage, intriguing thing. I know the voice is dying with a dying fall beneath the music of a farther room. Now, one of the big connections right there is going to be at the end, isn't it?
The chambers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, but you've got something else. Voice is a very, you know, you talk about authentic voice in poetry, you're talking about where a guy's person, you know, he's got a voice, a very particular character, and not just a style, you know, there's a real voice there, an authentic voice, a major one, a person. And you get these voices, there's another take on it, the voice is dying with a dying fall beneath the music of a farther room. Now, later, he's going to, right there he says that he's going to be formulated on a wall and they're going to do this certain kind of thing to him. But he has done a certain kind of thing to them too. You say, how much reality do the other people in here have, you know, as persons? Is it only because they're just total turkeys and Proof Rock is the only one? Or has he somehow killed them off too? This farther room, the music from the farther room covers their voices while he is in the room. You know, is that going on? Has he murdered with fantasy where others have murdered with formula? You know, formula. Okay, anyone?
About what you said about knowing the evenings, mornings, and afternoons, about this knowing them all and whether he killed them, that I guess I jump ahead to 76 and 78, I guess, that the long fingers are his own. He's got it like a lap dog on the cat or whatever on the floor by his chair. Those things he's put it, domesticated it, he's pigeonholed it as a, something that takes up space in the room. Not more than that. Afternoon meeting.
I don't know.
Reaching.
I don't know how to speak to that right now. Yeah, Rich.
Just a visual image that comes off the two pages. He says he knows them all, except that when he gets specific about how he knows them, he knows voices, and he knows eyes, and he knows arms. Like he knows pieces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how do they know him? From the preceding paragraph, they say his hair is growing thin, and how his arms and legs mm-hmm. are thin. It's like people are not dealing with whole people. Mm-hmm. He with them, or them mm-hmm. with him. But they're dealing in little bits, scraps mm-hmm. of pieces. He doesn't know them. He knows a voice. He knows mm-hmm. an eye. Mm-hmm. The eye, he's scared to death of their eyes
mm-hmm.
all through this thing. Yeah. And he knows an arm. And even that changes when the light changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they know him too.
And it's the superficial things, the trivial things
yeah.
that take on this huge proportion. Again, Elise's thing about the proportion here is just, just bent all out of shape. Yeah.
The other thing that when we talk about pieces, that part of the I don't have a copy of the poem that it's where he wakes, she says, well, that wasn't the question anyway. That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
That really struck me that he didn't have anybody in this whole, all these groups, whatever they are, there's one person, maybe the person that's apparently an intimate acquaintance who is okay, on this thing, kind of pull things together a little bit. At this passage, there's a whole lifetime of evidence against him. A whole lifetime of evidence against him. The witness is discredited, clearly, and yet he's the only kind of witness there can be to a sickness, which is this thing. Who else? Yet, we've got this, you could talk to a non-Christian, and you talk, they look at your life, but you look, I know all this about you. How can you
possibly, you know, talk about being sons of God, you know, and so forth. And they just, because there is evidence. There's evidence all over the place. Weakness, and you wonder. You do wonder in situations when you recognize something is wrong and yet you do not have something positive yourself to offer, except the criticism. You know, okay, wise guy, what do you suggest? And then it's frightening. You don't know what's right, but you know you can sniff what's wrong, and you're at that crazy place to where you've had some vision, you've heard music from a farther room, but it hasn't sung to you yet. You know, you're that crazy fellow like in Hamlet who crawls between heaven and, you know, and heaven and earth. Yeah.
Don't you, if you can criticize, doesn't that automatically imply that you do have something else to offer? If a criticism is a...
No. Well, it's
you must have a vision or something that says that's wrong. Right?
You must have had a vision that gives you the idea that it's wrong, but you at the time, you know, you don't know what's right, and you allow not knowing what's right to keep you from making the criticism if you're a certain kind of person or in a certain kind of mood or time of your life. I mean, you're very frightened. Criticizing your peer group, you know, for doing something. You've made noise before. You know, I happen to be making noise now. You've made noise before. Who are you to talk and tell me to be quiet and go in and eat? You know, just a mundane example like that, you know, but you shoot it up to big proportions. Yes, you can criticize. Yes, you have a vision of something. Yes, you can say something. Yes, you're going to get, you know, shot down. And it's frightening. There's evidence against you. I can say that, I used to think I could forget, but it was hard for me to forgive. It's a lot easier to forgive than forget, because all Elise and I have to do is have a fight, and I can remember every nasty thing, you know, that I could possibly have against her going back to, you know, 12 years. I forget. Huh? What?
Nothing.
Talk to me later. Talk to me after. I'll talk to you after class, teacher. Okay. The only movement is, I think, here is that is who said it? I think Marianne wriggling. The only human movement that we have is in this kind of wriggling. What's going to happen to me? I'm going to do, you know. And it's not an actual moving, but this is what the one picture of movement that we've got in here is going to be of human moving. Is going to be this wriggling, or that's the fear, that it's going to be zapped on the wall, that somebody has hit you with a pre-thought text, knows who you are, has got you pigeonholed, got you up against the wall, he's got all the arguments against you, just in the back of the mind. And how should I presume, and would anyone be interested, you know, is another thing, you know.
Does he know what the question is? Leads you to an overwhelming question, although you do not ask, what is it? I think of wriggling against the wall is, he makes the point and they, okay, I mean, what is it? What is the problem? I think of wriggling against the wall is...
But they'll pin it. I mean, if he says something, if he changes the subject of what's going on in the drawing room, they will change the subject to him. See? Bing! All of a sudden, he's under examination.
Yeah, I was just going to say the formulated phrase, is biology, but the formula that you set an insect into a jar and then pin them through and tack them on a board, and that he is pinned, and sometimes they become alive again.
Yeah.
But and they're with me, even mm-hmm. with the pain anymore.
You don't give
but the formulated, I just, that just kind of, the formula.
I hadn't, I didn't know that.
The ether.
That could be his.
Etherized.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and that's how he makes the connection with the sky to the ether, but then etherized. Yeah, and what, and in a sense, what's gonna happen is that now the patient is up against the sky. We're going to set about the dissection, which follows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he now does Proof Rock say this? No, Elliot? Yes. He says here comes the dissection.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this kind of thing gonna happen. Tremendous fear, and it spit out the butt ends of my days and ways. Oh boy, you know, my life is an ashtray. You know, my brain is an ashtray. Butt ends of cigarettes.
Yeah. What do they represent?
My life has been an ashtray. I look back, and here it is. I've measured out my coffee spoon. I measure out my life in coffee spoons, little bits, and what do I have left? You know, the butt ends, the used up, the butt ends of my days and ways. Your memory, your brain, your past is this ashtray.
Bruce said you make an ash out of
me. Yeah, make an ash out of yourself.
And also that generally, the time that
we
smoke the most is drinking coffee or having tea and cakes.
Yeah, tea and cakes. Nervously doing this.
Yeah. I can't remember when I come to death, but if it's near that wriggling place, there's the kind of intensity of being forced to speak in your defense. And finally, it gets so terrible, like, interrogation.
Yeah.
Under the light, under the kin, the people, fixing your eyes on you, and all of this work, the only confession that you can consider that the thing I'm here is the evidence of.
And that's all you can come up with. I mean, they've got evidence against you. They can put you on the wall. They can get the light on you. They can, you know, they can start asking. And then how should he begin? Spit out all the butt ends of his days and ways. And then would that carry any weight? All this dead stuff. You'll get that later in saying, you know, it would have been, you know, he's trying to talk. And after the sunsets, the dooryards, the sprinkled streets, the novels, the teacups, the skirts, you know. All these impressions that he's got with, but you know, really important to him, but no context. You know, I mean, I don't like. I've got all these impressions, but there's no pattern to them, and I'm gonna. Then they're gonna say, "You criticize? Why?" And all he can say is, "Sunsets, dooryards, sprinkled streets." And we get this especially right now. Well, down here, shall I say? You know, when he goes there. But let's. Get back to that. I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, down with light brown hair. You get this very romantic sort of movement in the first two lines, and then but, you know, contrary to this romantic thing, somehow the hair stops him. It he's at a position where that's kind of a. It's not like that Whispers of Immortality where Grishkin, you know, exudes this feline smell which drives him off. But here, hair on the arm, this very small thing. Where is this guy raised? He has evidence against him right here. They're going to look at his bald pate, his thin legs, as a critical thing. And he is going to be critical at this. I mean, he is going to see a kind of a rejection, you know. At the real, the physical, the image, fine. He's got at the end, he's got C girls. He doesn't have C women. He's got C girls. and there is this sense of there's some of the women's lip things, stuff has come out about shaving arms and leg, you know, shaving pits and legs and stuff. You know, and it's kind of an effort to keep women infantile, you know, and not to recognize the kind of the physicality they try to keep them infantile and also a sort of a spiritual thing instead of a, just a, you know, I stink like you do, Mon. Hey, Mon. Okay, and then, you know, hair on the arm puts him off, and what excites him? Synthetic perfume. You know, perfume. Makes him digress, you know. What is it that makes me so digress? Arms at violet, you know. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Then he gets these images.
From a dress and not a person.
Yeah, and by the way, the guys, okay, right. Okay, I haven't, digress, not a person, okay, right. Well, I'm going to, because this is a whole series of these distant, you know, superficial things. And that's one. In the sense of Grishkin, is I make something of that in what I write, and this will go along with that. Okay. It makes me so digress. And then arms that lie along a table, a wrap about a shawl. And should I then presume, and how should I begin?
How should I begin what?
Yeah, what? We don't know yet. I mean, there's some kind of a statement, some kind of a criticism, something, but we don't really know.
I think the fact that Kukrat is a man is really interesting. It's more interesting now, maybe, than an elephant, instead of a woman. All these kinds of, you know, so I will begin. I shall do this. Mm-hmm. Kind of aggressive. I get really afraid of men losing masculinity and women losing femininity as possibilities, and it's like that along with just simply mankind and being a person is the next step of identity for him, is to be a man. Mm-hmm. In relationship to women, he's, you know, not manly. And then
he
can't make these kind of, just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's a, Robert Penn Warren says that he has a neurotic repudiation of the real. Neurotic repudiation of the real and the physical.
What
and
repudiation.
Repudiation, he.
Disavows.
Yeah, he just. Yeah, no, get away. I don't want that. You know, the bracelets, you know, the whiteness, the bareness, fine. The brown hair. Oh, there's another color image, the brown. the brown hair. I'll take it white and black, but I don't, you know, I can't handle this. And this, okay, if you have this sort of neurotic, I mean, if hair turns you off, how are you going to ever grab anything? Enough to do anything. I mean, you know, here comes the angel and Prufrock says, ooh, you know, you smell or something like this. I mean, how you grab, wrestle, and here he's, you know, put off by that. Well, then how can he begin to do something when it would mean that he has to, you know, embrace the real. Really, he has to get in and embrace the real. And in a sense, too, in a sense, if this is, you know, I have known this girl, this particular girl, I've known the arms already, known them all, arms and bracelets and white and bare. This puts him in a really difficult position to then start criticizing what was fine before. You know, now what? How can he criticize? How can he begin to criticize? He has been a, you know, very intimate part of this world. And then how should I begin? And then he tries to begin. How shall I begin? We don't know what he's going to do. He's going to make a statement, but then he's thinking in his head, how should I begin? How should I presume? And how should I begin? Well, shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows. What's the subject? What's he talking about?
Himself.
Huh? It's a... It's a dooryard. Well, I mean, there's no... Shall I say... I'm going to say something, and shall I say this? It's a nice image, you know. But...
It's not the drawing.
I mean, yeah, it's not the drawing. It's from something outside. He's seen something outside. There's a different reality, but it just sticks there.
It's still a judgmental reality. I mean, these men sit there and watch you as you walk by. I mean, maybe saying that when I leave, there are other eyes out there to greet me as there are right here.
Well, I don't know if that's a judgmental. I don't think I could pin that on this one, because, I mean, in the cities, you know, you go and the people just, they're out there and that's it. And they're just looking out the windows and they're just watching. You know, these old women, you go in certain parts of cities or something, you look up and you see these people who just spend the whole day looking out the window.
But that the first thing he sees once he goes out there, and it's a statement about his level of perception.
Mm-hmm.
He runs out into all of these men in shirt sleeves and what, he picks out shirt sleeves,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, shirt sleeves.
And that paranoia.
That's good. That detail strikes
him. Looking down at him. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he seems like the person that would notice somebody noticing him.
Yeah.
He seems like the type of person that would notice someone noticing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I say that's a statement of him, of his level of perception. Once he walks out of the room, he sees that with the person outside.
You mean by his level of perception?
Well, that's
the kind of things he notices, I think, is what you mean. Kind of things he notices, and yet. You're going to get, okay, it's going to be lonely and you can do something with that, but I don't think do it now. He will say later, it's impossible to say just what I mean. You know, what will I say? Shall I say, that's an impression and it's a picture. Would make a good picture, and we got that picture in the preludes already developed, but it's impossible to say just what I mean. Then he feels this, and then he says, I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. There's the pictures of a crab, you know. Now, it's this, you've got an animality about that, but it sure would solve his problem. We wouldn't have these problems if, as a guy I just remembered now said, once last year, we wouldn't have problems if we were back in the Paleolithic, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Age, because he was having some problems with a guy who was in the group home, and the father says, you know, as a summation of the entire conversation that went on for something like, you know, I don't know, 3 hours, he goes over to the wall and looks at this picture and he says, well, we wouldn't have any troubles like this. I mean, this, if we were back in this primitive thing. But here, you get a picture of Prufrock, really. You know, he hears the music, but they're not singing to him. And he can't speak. But damn it, he's got to speak, but he doesn't have the words. My feeling, this is one of the passages that I relate to an awful lot. I used to scream when I was a teenager. In high school, I remember running out through the town, you know, I mean out of town into the country, you know, and wishing I was a moron, you know, just wishing I was a moron so I didn't see the need to speak and yet not have any words. This kind of, I didn't want to die, but you know, I wanted it to be easier. I didn't want to see all these things and then feel like I had to speak and then not have the words. That's why, this is one of the reasons why this poem meant a lot to me when I was 18. You know, especially, I've heard the music from a farther room, that idea. But they will not sing to me.
So what do you say?
I've seen, you know, it's one of the things. But there's this vision, but it's not complete, and I don't have the words, and I see the problem, but I can't be, who can, this little 18-year-old kid can see the problem, but how can I cure it? And then when I try to talk, it just kind of like, doop, sticks in the roof of my mouth. Yeah. Monks?
Shriek.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that connects to this kind of that, you know, without maybe a that kind of response where you still respond to it but you can't. That's it. Your response is all you have.
And you have enough sensitivity, and you've got enough intelligence to be neurotic. And you seem, and yet you feel like you're not there at the point where you can, you're sane and you're real, and you've got a mental thing going. That's part of it. Yeah.
Just another kind of image thing. That shall I say, business and everything that follows that seems to be a way of trying to get some credentials for himself that says, actually, I'm not a part of you.
I have seen something else.
I'm on the outside. Mm-hmm. I've been past the oyster bar.
Mm-hmm.
I've been down the slums, you know, those vacant buildings and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so actually, I'm going to criticize you from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So don't pin me on, don't pin me up against the wall, mm-hmm. because I'm really not one of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he says, I should have been, he leaves both the inside and the outside of the room all together and opts for sheer nothing.
Mm-hmm. It wishes it. The wish for that is kind of, it's like my wishing to be a moron is not a death wish, but it's a kind of death wish.
Yeah, but it's like it's a lie. You know you can't be.
Mm-hmm.
Now this guy says, I wish I were on the outside so I could say, I'm on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say that. That would be a lie.
Mm-hmm.
So I should have really been something which was a part of neither one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been a animal.
And he rejects both equally. Yeah.
Thing that Lewis has a thing about, he gets mad at the word bestiality because he says that beasts are never as beastly as humans who are not acting, who are in being human, cruel or vicious or
why not make the ultimate retreat if the reality is like that? Why go out there? The sense that I told the story when I was in the mental hospital to look, and not when I was in it as a patient, but when I was working in one, seeing the only people I saw were frightened nurses who hid in their little room and never came out among the patients. And this is a real poor hospital. And one huge, fat, 3-day beard growth guy in an inked, filthy t-shirt sitting up against this chain, this cross-wired door. throwing his keys all day long. He just sat there and didn't, his face did not change the whole day. He stared into the nut house and played with his keys while you had catatonics and old people and young people, and it was a bedlam. I mean, it was like makes, it's out of the 18th century down in Kansas. And then I'd say, that's what they see. Even this is better than that. And when I was in the hospital, I got to see Elise and the Sundowners. That was enough. I'll go out. You know, is that world out there, right? There was something out there. But his feeling, you know, you look out there and he sees, what does he see in the drawing room? Yuck. What does he see outside? Lonely men in shirt sleeves, leaning out of windows, smoking pipes. My God. You know, I just assumed I should have been this crab on the ocean floor, and then later you'll get the ocean in a different way, and not as a crab, but you'll get this sea image coming in, a sea creature of a different kind later. A sense of he's a man in the middle. He's wise enough and sensitive enough to want a better vision, and critical enough to kill his visions, his own visions, before they get off the ground. He's in the middle. He's Hamlet says, what kind of fellow is this man that crawls between earth and heaven? You know, like a worm, like an infant, like a snake. Ooh. Scary thing. And then what kind of thing happens? He wanted to speak, he tried to speak, he says he should be an animal, and the afternoon, the evening sleeps so peacefully. Smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. This is such a peaceful drawing room. This is so peaceful. It's twilight. And then, should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to his crisis on such a diet? Should I, after teas and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? After the diet of the tea and toast, after the diet of the nourishment from this drawing room reality, does what strength does it give him? Have the strength to force the moment to its crisis. And then I'll just go and then we'll talk about it. But I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, a great deal of anxiety. Then he says, yet it has come to nothing significant. Though I've seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter. I am no prophet. Here's no great matter. I've seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. And the sense of time, what happens to the sense of time here? There's time, there's time, there's time. And now in this passage, after he's tried to talk, then done the crab thing, then seeing how peaceful that drawing room was, then says, should I, after all, if that strength, then the time is running out. Here's the chariot. As in Marvel's poem, the chariot is at the back. It's coming up. I hear the chariot. He says, if I had world enough and time, you know, the first thing of the coy mistress, you know, if I had, then I would love you 30,000 years, and then, you know, 100 years for each eye, and so on, you know, and so forth. And you couldn't hurry my love anything any faster, because I'd have all this time. But I hear the chariot of time coming, you know, chasing me. I hear, see ahead of me deserts of, you know, deserts of eternity, an eternity of deserts. And so we have to quick and make love. And here, you have this sense that, you know, we have time, and then, uh-oh, the chariots are coming. Here comes. Yeah, yes.
Well, that footman, the eternal footman?
Yeah.
Snickering, I mean, even
Okay, snicker, when somebody snickers at you, he steals what?
Respect or self-respect? You question
dignity. Even death is going to... His death will lack dignity. Even his death will lack dignity.
That reminds me of the movie last night.
Oh, yeah, don't...
Oh, yes.
That movie, oof. That's what he had. You know, I will keep my dignity. I'm a dummy. I talk funny. I look ugly, but I do have dignity. Don't take that from me. I mean, oh, incredible movie. Okay. What about this? There were some people who said some things.
I'm thinking of the food, and should I have strength enough, and that this is tea and cakes and ices and marmalades. Nothing, they're
substantial.
Nice, but they don't have any protein substance.
Yeah, there's no roast beef and spuds. It's on this diet, on this, the nourishment that this world gives me, this drawing room reality gives me. I mean, what is this? It's a rationalization, isn't it? I mean, after all, should I, after teas and cakes and ices, have strength to force the moment to this crisis?
That's what they serve in the art galleries.
What?
That's what they serve in the art galleries.
Art galleries.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to an opening of an exhibit or something like that, you know, coffee and cookies.
Forever the catered reception.
Yeah,
the
catered reception. Yeah.
Must have just got married in that.
Yeah.
He's still in the room with the women.
Hmm?
No,
he's
still in the room.
Yeah.
That's the women are eating that stuff talking to Mark Holmes.
Yeah, and he's eating it too, and it's peaceful.
John.
You know, it's different now. He is saying, Ofta, it's so peaceful. And soothing. Yeah.
He says, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis. Is what I mean by that is make himself take a stand against that. Is that the crisis he's talking about? What we've been discussing, breaking free from his...
Yeah. Force the moment to its crisis. Break free. And then... you've got another question.
I don't understand why they went. He goes through the Wetton, past the Wetton Parade, and then through the John the Baptist thing. Right?
Okay. He has had he has been very very anxious
well that's sort of an image thing too, don't you think? I mean, he's caught up in images and everything else, and there's an image of being able to sacrifice the quality of the weakness, and fast, and weakness, and mm-hmm. It's sort of like wearing the right clothes for this thing. I really felt, you know, myself.
He has lamentation credentials.
Yeah, right.
You notice Scott still.
So that's sort of like, it's more rationalization after the tea and cakes and ices type rationalization. So like you said before, that he's rationalizing, he says, well, after all I've had is tea and cakes and ices, why should I have strength? You know? And here's, because, no, I guess I wouldn't be on the same line. But here he's saying, you're saying, I want to break free, and I've wept and fasted and wept and prayed about it, but I can't. Is that the type of energy?
Prophet's got the word of God, and even though, he says, but though, you know, but though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, and seen my head grown slightly bald brought in upon a platter, which is kind of this formulated phrase business again, I think, I am no prophet.
Yeah.
I don't have the word.
He doesn't have a focus in what he wants to say.
Yeah.
And then he sets it off and says, but here's my great manner.
Yeah.
Does he?
He's denying.
Is he contradicting himself there about this? Does he really believe? Does Prufrock believe that here's no great matter? Does he believe his own words? Because he says, I wept and fasted, wept and prayed, seen and no prophet. Those hit and here's no great matter sounds like, that sounds funny.
He gets distance on himself. This business of the irony is the unexpected, you know. It's not the exaggerated response, it's the unexpected response to a given situation. And you say, and just remember we talked about this, you know, Prufrock sees irony. Here's my diet, teas and cakes and ices, and how on this am I going to have strength to force a moment to the crisis? You know, it just won't work. And then he says, but though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, you know, he gets in this image of himself, and then he cuts it down. You know, you get this big, you know, almost this, it's almost self-pitying tone, which just is countered again, like we were seeing all these, you know, minus one, plus one, minus one.